The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 638, October 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. This is a special old spooky club.
Chain rattle.
1982 is not old.
I am your host. Well, it's old for spooky. I am your host, Jason Snell. This is an episode suggested by Steve Lutz. Hello, Steve Lutz.
Hello. Yes, once approximately every 15 years, an episode that I have suggested ends up actually being recorded. So this is a very special day.
Shocktober! We are discussing The Thing from 1982, John Carpenter's.
Not that thing, the other thing.
The Thing.
Wait, which thing?
That the thing we're talking about.
The Thing. I got that.
And not the later thing.
No, not
this,
the...
This is the thing in the middle.
It's not the later thing. It's not the thing from another world. It's not the ever-loving blue-eyed thing from Marvel Comics. Ben Grimm. It is 1982's The Thing, directed... Sorry, as the movie would style it, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Sure.
You heard him. It's Philip Michaels. Hello.
Hello, and I believe that it is, in point of fact, clobbering time for The Thing.
Okay, great. And Erica Ensign is also here. Hello.
I am here for any movie with that much real Canadian snow.
Also, I'll point out that we've already had more women voices in this podcast than are in this film.
Well, she needs about 26 more seconds to beat Adrienne Barbeau's record.
As the voice of the chess computer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I hope I make it.
That Kurt Russell calls a horrible name for no good reason.
We have no idea what the gender of the shape-shifting alien in this film is.
So. Well, it's whatever it wants to be, I guess. Mm-hmm. Its only identifier is thing. It goes sure. by thing. That's what it is. It's a thing.
Its pronouns are thing and thing.
And thing. We did an episode where we talked about The Thing from Another World, which is a pretty fun black and white movie that, the monster is kind of a plant, but it's I enjoyed
it. Walking carrot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But
this
it's black
is,
and white, so you can't tell.
Right.
But it's real carroty.
So this like that film is based on a novella by John Campbell called Who Goes There? And I think that the idea here was to go back to the source material and, there's backstory here about how John Carpenter was like, why would I want to remake that movie? That was a good movie. And then he reads the novella and he's like, okay, I can make this, it's a little bit more than a walking carrot. We could probably do something with that. And they made
a little more.
So they made, this movie. I find fascinating about this movie that it got not very good reviews and didn't do very well when it came out.
It got terrible reviews. Yes. I was shocked at how much people hated it.
Yes, yeah. It totally bombed at the theater. I think it made back its cost, but just barely. And for the most part, I think it was less disliked than it was just kind of ignored, which was also weird. Mm-hmm. But it is a bit on the bleak side. It was released in June of 1982, which is not a great time of the year for horror movies, let alone ones that take place entirely in the snow. Mm-hmm. And then this is often mentioned, but it also came out exactly 2 weeks after E.T., which probably sucked up all the moviegoers who were in the market for a movie about aliens.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a cuter alien.
Yeah.
Would I rather
enjoy the heartwarming tale of a cute extraterrestrial who forms a special bond of love with a young boy? Or would I rather watch a pile of mucus and body parts eat a man's head?
I mean, it depends on the day, really.
Yeah, well, it's a sunny summer day in June of 1982, so I feel like most people probably lent to the former.
It's funny, though, because, of course, it has come to be recognized as a classic, which is this is, you know, sometimes you get those movies that are like, well, it didn't find an audience, but the people who found it loved it and it became a cult classic. I feel like that is usually the trajectory. This is like, no, people rejected the thing. They didn't like it and right. They didn't want to see it. And then which I think says something about the zeitgeist. I think absolutely. E.T. is cited. People cite Star Trek 2. Like, there were a lot of movies with like a different and more positive vibe than this horror movie. People were not ready for it. Maybe it was the timing that it came out.
They
summer.
Cite the recession.
I don't know.
I
mean,
times were not great. it was one of the early beneficiaries of VCRs and home entertainment.
Yeah.
Because you can, this and Clue are two movies that people, they came out in the theaters. It's not like people whatever. People like angrily rejected those movies. And then people got to rent them and said, this is actually pretty good.
And the damn kids took the tape home and watched it a million times and said it was great.
Yep.
And that changed it.
Time I saw it for the first time in college, it was widely accepted that The Thing was a good movie.
Yeah, happened pretty fast, right? Like after the VHS came out and people started watching it and got a chance to see it. And it's so influential too, I feel like. It is based on some previous material. Before we started the show, Erica and I were talking about how the classic Doctor Who format of the base under siege.
Yep.
This is one of those. It's a great format for a claustrophobic kind of scary adventure kind of story. So it also has left its imprint on other movies too. So, and it's got, you know, I was thinking about Alien and Aliens a little bit when I was watching this. Alien precedes it. I felt like John Carpenter saw Alien, and then when he was thinking about The Thing, he was like, I know, I'll just do Alien, but I'll do that one scene like 8 more times.
and in fact, some of the reviews for The Thing said, this is just a crappier version of Alien, or a grosser version of Alien.
Well, I mean, okay,
different.
I don't think I would.
I don't agree with that criticism. Okay.
I'm going to slightly agree with it in the sense that I do think that you can draw a line from Alien to The Thing, and I do think The Thing is, you know, it's coarser. It's trying to be gross. I agree. And yet they are more similar than they are different. And I think that Alien is hailed as a great movie. And that's The Thing should be too, because it is headed in that direction of it. It's, I mean, again, you know, you look at Kurt Russell in the beginning, and knowing what I know, I'm like, well, I can pretty much guess that everyone else is going to die except Kurt Russell, which actually doesn't happen.
But when you got Keith David in your movie, you keep him around.
You keep him around. Keith David, because you never know when he might need to narrate a documentary about baseball. So you got to keep him around.
Yeah, it's frankly, it shouldn't be underplayed, the grossness of this movie, because that grossness is unbelievably quality. It's so well done. I think Rob Bottin.
So sticky and gross.
Absolutely. I mean, and everything about it is foul and drippy and gooey. And Rob Bottin, I don't know if he won any awards for this. Probably not, because nobody watched it. But it is. I think it's perhaps the pinnacle, or very close to, of practical creature effects. And even 40 years later, there are one or two scenes in here where there's stop motion that you can notice, but almost everything still hits the way it did in 82. And that's amazing, considering, you know, it's 40 years old, It's great stuff.
The second thing that shocked me when researching this is I said, oh, well, this was when they started having makeup awards in the Oscars. So clearly it should have been at least nominated, because I think the year before American Werewolf in London had been nominated for the makeup award. And no, it was not nominated. The winner that year, Quest for Fire.
Oh, man.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah. That movie.
So it's like it is. There was a coordinated anti-thing campaign at some point.
No, really.
All of society just turned its back on the thing and was like, nope, yeah, we're not going to talk about that movie, which is kind of funny. Okay. So the moment in this movie where I realized that it was going to wear not just its heart on its sleeve, but all its organs on its sleeve.
Several hearts.
Is there's a moment where they're trying to figure out what caused a person's death. And so the doctor removes all of his organs, and the camera's like, I'm just going to park here while we remove organs from the cavity of the guy's body. And I'm like, okay, ground rules set movie, right?
Like, well, I mean, technically it's not really a guy. It's kind of a pile of burnt limbs and assorted strange looking bits that don't seem quite human.
Yes, so it's true.
A lot more faces than I typically imagine.
Yeah, yeah, but it's one face that's stretched out across about 10
feet. True. It's
but sure.
But in the end, there's just a bunch of human organs on the inside, and we lovingly watch as they're all extracted, and that movie is sending a very important signal there about what kind of movie this is going to be.
I appreciated the line afterwards too, explaining that they were all normal human organs, because that's all right. I saw was just a bunch of, you know, goo and shapes and
goo
blood
blobs.
And it was important for me to know thematically that some
us,
of it,
Erica,
was actually normal,
but a loose assemblage of goo and blobs and blood.
Well, fair. I mean, absolutely fair.
Fair point. It's and so it's going to be a gross movie. I have some questions, and I'm not going to be that person who is like the every single movie has to be, well, you know, Steven Spielberg couldn't show The Shark because it was broken and it improved the movie. Which is, you know, is a cliche and it's overdone. But I will say, one of my thoughts upon watching it, so I like this movie a lot. I think it's really good. I think part of it is that it feels so familiar because it has been so influential with so many people. But I think it's very good. Early on in the movie, I did, like, I guess John Carpenter, he's a genius. He knows what he's doing. But like, I was thinking to myself, I kind of wish he had shown restraint in the first third or half of the movie, where there are scenes that give away what the creature is or what forms the creature can take, where I felt like maybe I wanted it to build. And I realize this is John Carpenter stepping forward and saying, no, I'm not going to hide anything. But like, there's the scene with the dogs, and it's like, there's the dogs, and then a thing comes out and has the legs and it kills the dogs and all that stuff. And I thought, would it be more effective to build the tension if we cut away from the dogs and didn't know what happened, other than that there's horrible things happening? And I had that at a few points where I thought, you know, would it be more effective if he had saved it a little bit and shown a little restraint in the beginning? And that's the part that makes me feel like that's the horror movie director sense, which is like, nope, we got to give the people what they want.
Sure.
My question for you, Jason, is in this theoretical version where he does restrain, are the other characters seeing it and we are just not, or is it completely hidden? Because I think it's important, at least for the characters, to have seen what's happening in order to give them the motivation to have the reactions that they have. I think if they don't see it, then you turn it into a different kind of psychological thriller, which is not what is.
Yeah, and I guess that is sort of what I'm getting at here, is that I wish the whole movie was a little more psychological than it is, that it built a little bit slower, and that the characters had a little more time of sort of like realizing what they're seeing. And that's not what this movie is. This movie is very much like nope, there's an alien monster, and we all know it because we all saw it, and it grew legs and crawled around like a spider for a while until we set it on fire.
Sure.
I think I would have had more trouble with the movie under those circumstances if the characters still sort of made the same decisions, because they're making dumb decisions left, right, and center. I'm just going to go off over here, and we're going to split up, even though we know.
Yeah.
That being alone is bad. And I feel like I can chalk those decisions up to the panic of having seen the things that they have seen. Whereas if we didn't have the gross out horror stuff that had just been like literally shoved and splashed in their faces, that maybe they would have thought a little more carefully before they took some of the actions they did. So, I mean, while I think I would like to see that movie, that fictional idea of a movie, I think it would be a different movie, and I would also still want to have this one exist for me to watch. Although I will say, I actually just watched this for the first time last night. Somehow, this yep. John Carpenter movie no, has same. Always just been on my I'll get to it eventually sure. list. So I had never seen it, and I also never bothered to look up anything about it. Literally, the only things I knew about it were that it was a John Carpenter movie, that it stars Kurt Russell. And that it is, you know, similar to the John W. Campbell story and the previous movie. So yep. I was like delighted by like the cast and the gore, and like mm-hmm. I knew none of that stuff going in, and it was really fun
for sure.
Yeah, and it would have been a shame to have to cut back on some of those gore scenes, because they did spend 10% of the budget on it. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. There's one of the flaws, I think, in this movie for me is that the nasty stuff that goes down is a little bit middle-loaded and front-loaded. And the ending giant creature is kind of lame after everything you've already seen.
Yeah.
Along with, fair. Like, you don't even get to see how Gary and Knowles are dispatched. I mean, you get to see Gary carried around like a bowling ball, which is fun, but Knowles just disappears. And then all of a sudden this thing pops out of the ground and he blows up, and that's it. That's the end. So it feels like, things were rushed a little bit there. And, meanwhile, in the middle, you've got what I think is probably one of the best single sequences of gross stuff going on in rapid succession of all time.
Oh my God.
Which might have been better.
When all the guys are tied up together in chairs.
That's one of them, but
I'll tell you about the
defibrillator scene.
Poor Norris trying to be revived.
Yeah.
It's a very alien kind of,
it is. Any scene where a man's hands are chomped off by another man's chest, and that is not even the grossest thing in the movie. Mm-hmm. That's a scene, friends.
Right.
It is quite a thing. Although the scene that I loved is, and I guess maybe this says the kind of psychological terror that I prefer to see, is I love the idea that they tied all these guys up to chairs and then one of them turns into an alien monster.
Yes.
And all the other guys are still tied next to them in
and
their own chairs
together. Mm-hmm.
And then a guy does kind of get his head bitten off. But you know, it's sort of, but that scene was amazing, and it's so intense, and it's so, you know, because you're in the mind of the people who are there, and Kurt Russell just can't get that flamethrower to light.
Right. And Palmer's head is like melting and splitting in half while these guys are jumping up and down, and then he stands up with the chair and the other two guys still attached to it.
Yeah.
It's a very comic scene, as is the Norris scene at one point, you know, when the head tries to make a beeline for the door.
Oh, wow.
Aren't supposed to have legs.
Wow.
Yeah, they grow. Yeah, it turns into a spider, but it's also still a head.
If somebody described that scene to you, you wouldn't believe that it had been filmed. Doc slams the paddles onto Norris. Mm-hmm. Norris's chest splits open into a huge mouth. The mouth grows gigantic bear trap like teeth, which then slam shut on Doc's wrist, neatly removing his hands. A bunch of tendrils shoot out of Norris's chest and form a creature on the ceiling that consists of spidery legs, some waving baby arms, spaghetti, and a long hairy neck with a messed up Norris head on the end.
Mm-hmm.
They shoot it with the blowtorch. While they're at it, Norris's real head decides to make a beeline for the exit, so it stretches off of his body and over the edge of the table he's lying on. And then a 6-foot-long tongue shoots out and attaches to a nearby desk, which he uses to pull itself away from the flames. And then the upside-down head sprouts a set of spider legs and two long eye stalks and tries to sneak away.
Yeah.
He scuttles off.
And almost does it, but not quite.
How do you even storyboard that and think you're going to get away with filming it and it working in some way? And yet it's so well done that it feels real. And that's insane.
And then their reaction to seeing the head, the legs after all of the rest of that was just, it was just perfectly underplayed.
You got to be effing kidding is what the guy says.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is even funnier because you later learn that he's one of the guys that's been subsumed by the thing. So it's almost like the thing is in awe of itself and how ridiculous it's being.
This episode of The Incomparable is brought to you in part by ExpressVPN. You probably heard by now you should be using a VPN when you connect to the internet. Adding an extra step to everything you do every day, it sounds like a hassle, but if you knew how easy it was to protect your connection with ExpressVPN, you'd be already doing it. Yes, you would. ExpressVPN, the easiest way to browse safely, securely, and just better. So many reasons to use a VPN. Maybe you're away from home. I've taken international trips and wanted to get back to my Netflix or HBO Max or something. Guess what? VPN will get you back to the US from the perspective of the internet. And I know people do it the other way too. You can do that too. But that's the thing that I love to do, is connect back home so that all my services that I'm paying for know that I am a U.S. member and that I want to see the stuff that I would see in the U.S. ExpressVPN gets rid of all those things that you might have hated about other VPNs you've tried. First off, it's blazing fast. Lots of other VPNs slow your connection to the point where it's not even worth it to connect. I've been there. You connect and you're like, all right, I'm doing this good. And then everything slows to a crawl. ExpressVPN doesn't lag or buffer. You can stream HD video with no issues. And using it couldn't be easier. Just open the ExpressVPN app, click one button, and enjoy instant protection across all your devices. It's that simple. Once you connect to ExpressVPN, you don't even realize you have it on. Your connection is secure. Your data is encrypted. You can set to whatever location you want to be in. And it's all just so easy. That's why CNET called it the best VPN. That's right. Go to expressvpn.com/snell. You can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/snell, S-N-E-L-L, to get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN. expressvpn.com/snell, my last name. Thank you to ExpressVPN for supporting The Incomparable.
My favorite reaction in the movie is in that scene where they're all tied up and Donald Moffat says, I understand we've all been through some stuff, but would you mind untying
this? Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Because I was sitting next to that monster as it was going through all of that. It's a great moment. The scene has the very carefully paced blood test scene. Yeah. So the idea here is he gets the idea from the head sprouting spider legs that it's not blood that comes out of you if you're a simulated human. It's more of the thing, and it will not want to be destroyed. So if I attack the blood, if it's blood, it just sizzles. But if it's not blood, it will try to get away because it's part of the thing.
I mean, and that's pretty smart.
Yeah. And so that leads to Kurt Russell standing there with his flamethrower and his exposed wire. And it's very much like, well, what about
literally
you?
An exposed wire, people. This is a family show.
What about you? And what about you? And you know, it's like you seem pretty nice. It's probably not you. But that's like you're a jerk. It's probably you. Oh, it's not you. Okay, right. Like that's one of the nice elements of it is that everybody's got their suspects, but it turns out not to be those.
And they
suspects.
Test the guy he just had to shoot, which you know means that he's just killed a guy who was normal, although a bit of a weirdo. So
who was also trying to get him.
Also coming right at him. It was self-defense.
Yeah. Clearly.
Yeah. But and that leads to the one blood test that of course it immediately jumps up and tries to flee and turns into a monster, and then we get the whole thing with everybody tied together in the chairs. I thought that was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant piece of work. I think, and maybe this is, again, my bias, but I feel like that's the kind of thing that this movie does incredibly well.
I see what you did there.
And then the next thing will be. So the thing that I don't like as much is I think the psychological element of like anybody could be the monster is not as well handled, that there could have been more made out of the idea that any one of us could have been the monster and not even know. And also the premise that it invades your cells and sort of takes you over. I thought there was maybe even a lack of, it was like a missed opportunity to have that kind of level of horror depicted in some way, that like you think you're you and you're, you know, eaten alive essentially by this thing. And that stuff was not as, I would say, as well handled as the, you know, creatures chomping off people's arms and jumping around and stuff, which was brilliantly handled.
It was also a little confusing at first for me. I mean, I was willing to just sit back and go for the ride, but I wasn't sure if it was like a pod people thing where like there's another body out there and it's pretending to be you, because they kept saying it's pretending to be human. And that at first it took me a little while to realize, oh, it's not that like that, you know, somebody's body is off in the snow and this is a complete fake. It has somehow possibly ripped through the clothes, and like, and was that a red herring completely? Or like, there were a lot of little bits and pieces where I was just like, okay, I've only seen this the once. I have not completely followed the dots from A to B to C until we got towards the end of the movie, where I realized, especially like that the blood test scene was like, okay, so it's just taking them over cell by cell. We got that great you know, computer generated very slow picture of a cell being taken over and Wilford Brimley staring at the screen and figuring out how
looks
long
like
it would
take. Rendered on an Atari 2600.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't until that point in the film that I actually kind of started to even understand what was happening.
Yeah. All right. Well, as somebody who's watched this movie several times over the last 40 years, I can tell you that the explanation for how the thing actually takes over bodies never makes any more sense.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that is very simple. I don't think John Carpenter cares about those kind of details.
That is what it seems like. Yep.
I don't think he's very interested in it. I think he's perfectly fine just leaving that as a thing that's sort of ill-explained.
I see what you did there.
And yeah, thanks. Jeez. Are we really going to do this?
No.
I guess I set it in motion, so it's my own fault. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think this movie in the Carpenter canon is interesting because part of the reason I think this is a great movie and I usually recommend it to people who are sort of interested in horror and not necessarily, you know, big horror people, is that Carpenter, you know, he's well known for making most of his movies on kind of a non-existent budget. And because of that, I think most of them, except the ones that are kept to a really kind of simple, narrow focus, tend to feel, I guess unfinished might be too hard of a word, but they tend to be like a little bit ramshackle.
Rough around the edges.
Rough around the edges is a good way to put it. When he made The Thing, he was riding high on the success of The Fog and Escape from New York. And so he was actually given some money to work with for a change. And I think you can see it in the finished product. It's very polished for a Carpenter movie. It does still have plot holes and some glaring flaws, though, mm-hmm. as you point out. And I think that's just because that's John Carpenter. It's like, that stuff doesn't really matter. Right. What matters is mm-hmm. seeing a pile of goo with teeth on the end eat a man's head. And I think also that while I agree, Jason, that leaning into more of the psychological elements of this would have made for an interesting movie, it would have also made for a very different movie, as Erica points out. And this comes in at a fairly tidy hour and 48. I feel like if they had expanded it to include more of that, it would have ended up being longer and maybe a bit ponderous.
I agree.
Apparently there's a cut when they showed it on TV that had more backstory.
Oh, I have that on my special edition DVD. I'll have to check that out.
I'm not sure that I might have read that incorrectly, but
okay.
I think to make it less gross, but I think there was a push to add more backstory to the characters, and I do know that John Carpenter disavowed that cut.
Yeah.
I think, Steve, I think you nailed it, which is that this is not... When I was trying to get this across when I said there's another movie that it's sort of that it this movie is not, I think it does come down to bottom line, John Carpenter's not interested in that movie. And right. that's, I don't blame him for that. Like, he knows what this movie is. And he made a classic, right? Like, I mean, there's nothing against that. And in fact, I know I've said this on this podcast a few times, but like, part of it is from a 2022 perspective, like, all the screenwriters are very clever and they've seen all the classics and they've decided to subvert them or twist them in a certain way. And so when I say, like, what would you do with this movie today? I think the answer is sort of what I said, which is there would be bodies out in the frozen wastes who would be, sure. that would be evidence, because you'd have to have that moment where somebody goes out having talked to somebody and then finds their body and realizes and has to double back. You would want to do that bit. That would be a good bit of business. And likewise, some of the other psychological stuff, it would be good little bits of plotty kind of business in order to do the twisty turny thing. And could that be good? Yes, it could. It could also be bad, but it could be good. Mm-hmm. But it's not what John Carpenter is trying to do here, which is have a movie that really has some propulsion behind it. And that's one of the things I really admire at 109 minutes, is this movie starts and it moves. And even the talky bits early on, where they're like in the aftermath of the opening, it's already setting up the premise. It just keeps on rolling. And I admire that about it, even though I wish there had been more of those other elements. Like, I admire the director for saying, no,
nah.
that gets in my way. I know what I'm doing here. And he does. Mm-hmm. I also mentioned, speaking of the opening, I love the opening of this so much because it's so strange and fascinating, right? It is a dog.
Yeah.
And then there's a helicopter and you're like, well, why is there a helicopter? And then the helicopter shoots at the dog and you're like, well, why would a helicopter shoot at a dog? And again, in a modern movie, it would be like 24 hours earlier. By the way, that mm-hmm. would be the 2011 version of the thing.
Yes, that is. Mm-hmm.
Is literally yeah. that. But,
and then they try to drop grenades on the dog, yeah. which seems...
And then it crashes and a guy dies, but the other guy gets out and he's shooting and the people get shot and they shoot back and they kill the guy and they're like, what is going on? And it's such a great setup of like the mystery of, well, why would they be killing that trying to kill that dog? Also, it's hilarious that the people on the base are like, wow, I guess those guys just really didn't like dogs. Anyway, we've got a dog now.
Yeah,
that, another dog.
My daughter wandered into the where I was watching the movie at the beginning. No before I remembered how really gross that is, and she didn't see anything terrible, but she sees the person going after the dog, and she's like, oh, I don't like that guy. I'm all, well, don't you worry about it. Also, no. That's not a dog.
You know, if they did make this movie again today, I think another thing they might do is put a bunch of women in it. And that would make it a very different movie, because I think maybe people would stop and think a little bit more before they act, because this felt to me, and I enjoyed it for what it was, but it felt to me like the dutiest dude movie that I have seen in a very long time, which is another facet of John Carpenter movies, which I enjoy.
Sure.
But it made me giggle more than once to just be like, really, is nobody stopping to think... okay, like the one smart moment in the movie is the blood test thing, and everything else is just testosterone and adrenaline. Go,
right.
go, go.
And you can almost excuse the stupid moves that they make just based mm-hmm. exclusively on these guys are running entirely on adrenaline and testosterone, and that's...
Yeah. And whiskey.
And whiskey. But the whiskey, yes. I think, is what gives
whiskey.
MacReady the
Boy,
idea.
The J&B people really must have felt taken when they signed this deal to be featured in the movie. They're, oh, this is good. We're in a big Hollywood movie. I'm sure our product will be played and showed in a respectful... Oh, my God!
Yeah.
It's the perfect beverage to keep you company as you freeze to death in the snow.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, as a Canadian, I can say, yeah, sure.
Sure.
Now, one of the problems, I think, with the fact that this movie moves at a brisk pace, mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that I think was most complained about in a lot of the reviews of the time, and this is what I think Roger Ebert complained about mightily in his 2.5-star review, which mm-hmm. isn't bad. You know, he appreciated the nasty, gross stuff and enjoyed that, but the complaint is a valid one, and that's that with 12 main characters, all of whom are dudes, and generally bundled up in snow clothes all the time, they're almost indistinguishable.
Yeah.
The first time you watch it, and there's basically no time to fit in any character development. And so for everybody but MacReady, Kurt Russell, about the most that you get, and I have to tell you who MacReady is, because trying to match up the names to the actors is impossible, no. Even as somebody who's watched this 10 times. All you get for these people is that they're all a little weird, which is not surprising for a bunch of guys who signed up to spend the winter in Antarctica. But it doesn't give you much reason to care when they get turned into goo. And so I think that is a casualty of the brisk pace. I'm not sure how much it would add to have that character development, because, again, that's not what this is going for.
But yeah, agreed.
I understand the criticism of it, and possibly it would have added something.
In a different movie with more of the psychological, like, who are you, who am I, which one of us is the thing, all of that, having a better idea of who the people are could be helpful. But I do think, again, John Carpenter's sense here is very much like, well, I need more guys because I got to kill them. Right.
Yeah.
And I got a whole movie where I got to kill them. So I need a lot of them so I can kill them all.
Right. Honestly, to me, it felt just right. And I mean, yeah. Maybe that was just the excitement of finally seeing this movie after hearing about it for so many years. It was like, no, that was exactly how much character development I needed for each of them. Like, I do have trouble with the names and putting them all together. But some of them I got pretty quickly. And
right.
And like, you know, some of them were a little more on the caricature side than I would have liked. But that's all right. Overall, sure. it worked for me.
The trick is to recognize them by their beards.
I agree. I think there's just enough broad personality strokes on these guys.
Yeah.
Wilford Brimley is a curmudgeonly type who, you know, is a little unhinged, becomes increasingly unhinged. You know, the dog handler Clark is just kind of an oddball who's
likes
know,
dogs,
an outsider,
really
and spends,
likes dogs
a lot more than the people. You get that pretty quickly.
Yep.
You know, there's the stoner guy and the lazy radio operator, and then the cook who doesn't care if people are trying to sleep because they got shot that day. You know, you don't really need much more than that because they're just going to be dispatched in short order.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
By the way, I would like to introduce my favorite IMDb trivia note ever.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Someone took the time to log on to IMDb and note, there are characters nicknamed Mac and Windows in this movie. However, since the movie predated the Macintosh by a couple of years, it is likely just a coincidence.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, that's delightful.
Wow. That is...
Wow.
Windows does get his head eaten by a creature whose head is just jaws. So, you know, that tracks, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The literal blue screen of death for
yeah,
him.
I guess so.
And Mac freezes and his eyes turn into X's.
Yeah, like I can, I'm with Erica. I can picture what the thing 2022 would be like. And there would be fewer characters. There would be women. We would know more backstory. It would be more psychological. Like, and I'm not sure that would be, that might, again, well done. That could be a good movie. But what I admire about this movie is that, and I think this may be why this movie is so successful, is John Carpenter knows exactly what he wants to do, right? Like he knows exactly what this movie needs to be or what he wants it to be. And he makes it the best version of that, right? And I think what he's got going for him is some strong bones here, which is base under siege, totally out in the Antarctic, so they're completely alone. They can't call for help. There's the radios don't work. And
a basic premise that he has mined with great success already, like 3 times in his career at this point.
Yeah. No, it's
a winner.
It is a fantastic premise. And then what's the purpose of this one? And the purpose of this one is, and yes, this is the plot of Alien. Yeah, I mean, it is a great plot. You should use it. I recommend Base Under Siege.
Yeah, it's Doctor Who did it for an entire season in the 60s.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. And in this particular iteration of it, you know, he's got a few ideas about how he wants to have it play out, and he executes on that. I think there are some funny moments, like Kurt Russell at one point is like, look, I'm just going to go sleep in my cabin. And it's like, dude, something very strange just happened here. Maybe you should stick around. And he's like, no, I just want to go sleep in my
This is such
cabin.
A John Carpenter movie that the one time that he doesn't do the soundtrack to his own movie and gets Ennio Morricone to do it. Ennio Morricone is basically imitating a John Carpenter soundtrack.
It's like he borrowed his Casio and used the same demo sample.
I saw a bunch of quotes from Ennio Morricone. They talked to him about this like 10 years ago. And he said, basically, it's like, well, I know what kind of movie John Carpenter wants to make. So I had the orchestral thing and I had the synthesizers and I thought, I'm just going to give him the synthesizers. And so, yeah, it's like literally Ennio Morricone's like, John, I did some John Carpenter music for you. And he's like, great. And then apparently there are scenes where they didn't have the music for it. And so then John Carpenter added his own synthesizers. And you can't tell.
It's indistinguishable. It's,
no, you can't. It is Ennio Morricone doing his John Carpenter impression, which is amazing.
And he probably knew that's exactly what John Carpenter really wanted for him. So he got the same music for probably, several million more.
Yeah.
But a lot less work on his part.
Oh, fair point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I like
with
that.
Other stuff.
It's like I got this great guy to score my movie, and he's like, "Yeah, I know what kind of music your movies sound like. I'm just going to give you that. That's professionalism."
Apparently, won a Razzie for the worst score of the year.
Come on, because
the Razzies suck.
They suck. Yeah. They do.
Yeah,
I give the Razzies a Razzie.
Oh, there you go.
Oh no, they just collapsed in on themselves.
Good.
The Razzer has become the Razzed.
Oh, no. what a horrible development.
To be honest, Jason, that movie you're describing, the modern movie that is basically The Thing, but with women and character development and
CGI,
more psychological
probably.
Terror, sure. That's probably been made two or three times.
It probably
exists, and we probably just don't know about it because it's one of several dozen movies like that that exist now.
And the legacy of this is huge, right? Because there have also been movies and TV shows, almost uncountable, I would think, that owe a huge debt to The Thing because it is such a great, the isolation and the terror. Like, it's such a great premise. And yes, also The Thing owes, like I said, it owes a debt to Alien, owes a debt to The Thing from Another World, but that's how it works, is then you get The Thing, and then everybody sees The Thing and goes, this is amazing, and they make that X-Files episode where everybody's trapped in the snow with the parasite that's driving people crazy, and like, which is a great X-Files episode, by the way, and it just keeps going like that. But you can see, and so having not seen this movie was fascinating because I have seen this movie in the sense that I've seen a half a dozen or a dozen things that are homages to this movie, even though I haven't seen this movie. What I didn't know about it was who was gonna die how, which one was the alien and which one was not at various points. And the ending I didn't know, because I assumed it would be very much an Alien kind of ending where Kurt Russell is the last one left. And everybody, and then he finally dies.
That's what I was expecting.
He finally dispatches the alien, and then maybe he dies or maybe he doesn't. But it's kind of like one of those is going to be the way to go. And apparently, they scripted many and shot several endings for this movie. But the one they chose to go with is fascinating because in its ambiguity, and I also think it is the voice of the director saying, "I am going to remind you what this movie is actually about." Which is about connection and distrust and suspicion. And so in the end, what happens is, yes, Kurt Russell is victorious. And then Keith David walks out of the fog and is like, oh, hey, I just got lost. And there's this moment which is like, well, is he one or not? And they both basically are like, look, I hear that J&B Scotch is great in situations like this. and let's just sit here and freeze to death while drinking scotch. Yep. And that's how the movie ends, which I love. I love that it's ambiguous. I love that the movie's basically said, well, if one of them is the thing and they freeze, they'll just wake up and take over the world later.
There's going to be a rescue party out to find these guys probably right after winter.
When so we actually hope that they both just die.
Sure.
Because otherwise, if one of them's the thing.
And MacReady does say, you know, if one of us, you know, is going to take down the other one, neither of us is in any shape to fight back, you know, which is true. So you could take that to mean, you know, well, they're clearly both human because the thing would just take advantage of that fact. But maybe he wouldn't. Maybe he thinks, you know, well, these humans are made of sterner stuff and I could be taking a chance. So I'll just let him die and I'll freeze and we'll get on with it.
And a lesser movie and probably a modern movie would have the big heroic action where they blow each other up or they blow themselves up in ensuring that the world is saved.
Or
and
they
again,
could have like a 40-minute fight that takes up half the movie.
Yeah, and they open a portal to another dimension at some point. It's weird. But this movie doesn't do that. And again, I really admire that. I love ambiguous endings. I love, and this is why it didn't score well with audiences, by the way.
Yeah.
I love ambiguous endings though. And I love the fact that this movie is like, does the world end? Are these guys not, you know, not aliens and they're just sitting there sharing a last human moment before they both freeze to death? I don't know. You decide the end. And I think it's great. I love that this is the ending they chose.
Yeah, I am deeply ambivalent about ambiguous endings. Like there's a part of me that hates it, but actually I really like it. So I can understand why people would have left the theater probably at that time I was 5 years old.
It's not
but
satisfying.
Had I seen it later, but not now, I probably would have also been more frustrated, but at this point I also have firmly come down on the side of loving it, even though it intensely frustrates me. But that's okay. That's part of the joy.
There are certainly worse ways you could die than sharing a scotch with either Keith David or Kurt Russell. So
yeah, sign me up.
One of the things that's interesting about this ending is that it becomes clear with about 20 minutes left to go in the movie that they're all going to die.
Yeah.
That's something you don't see very often. You'll frequently see them leave open the possibility that, you know, oh, well, somebody might survive and might be able to restart the generator. They make it very clear that generator's gone. It's actually just been removed from the generator room
somehow. To build a flying saucer.
And the characters also recognize it. Like sometimes, occasionally you get like the audience knows where this is going, but the characters still are holding out some sort of hope. And in this case, we're all in it together. We all know this ain't going to end pretty. Like it's just going to be bad no matter what.
Yeah. So it's bleak for sure. And I get audiences, you know, especially ones who just saw E.T. 2 weeks before coming in.
Oh, yeah.
And
I don't know. This feels like a palate cleanser to me, honestly.
Well, E.T.
I mean, no shame
death,
to E.T.,
right?
But it's a little cloying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they kill E.T. off and then they're like, no, he got better. I'm like, and I love E.T., but like that always bothered me. It's like, oh, no, he's dead. We're going to go through all the drama. Oh, no, he's fine. Oh, whereas here it's like, no, we're all going to die and we know it and we just have to figure out what we're going to do here. And I love that. I love that about this movie. I get why it's not a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. But I love that about this movie and the fact that it lays down the rules that this is not going to go the way you think. And I think about, I don't know, I do kind of love movies that get to this point where you realize the point of this. First off, these people are fictional characters, right? It's okay. The actors didn't die. But also like the point of a movie isn't always, hooray, the fictional characters survived, right? The point of the movie is to make whatever kind of point it wants to make or leave you feeling the way you want, you know, it wants you to feel. And I was thinking about an analog to this is maybe Rogue One. Spoilers for people who haven't seen the Star Wars movie Rogue One, but one of the things I love about Rogue One is that there's a moment late in the third act when you realize, oh, every character is going to die. Like that is the moment. They're your moment. You're like, oh, they're not getting out of this.
Along with many Bothans.
They are doing, yes, and along with, oh God, it's, yeah, it's our characters and they're so surrounded by like 80 Bothans and you're like,
he should not have cast so many Bothans in this movie.
Uh-oh, never be around many Bothans, people.
Yeah, it's a bad idea.
Bothans in red shirts, just stay away.
Yeah, but it's that moment, and I got like a almost like a tingle when that happened, because it's like, it's like you're gonna do it, right? You're gonna, and it changes the movie, because it changes the purpose of the characters. The purpose of the characters is no longer to survive. In some ways, there's a purity to it, which is that they're fighting for a larger cause, because they're lost. But there's a larger cause. In this case, it's basically to kill this thing so that it doesn't destroy all of planet Earth. I like it when you get that shift in perspective. And that definitely happens in the last, whatever, 10, 15 minutes of the thing, where it's clear nobody's going to get out of this alive other than the monster, maybe, unless we kill it. I had another question for all of you, which is, there's a crash UFO. Which is pretty cool. Nice moment where they're like, oh, look, the Norwegians. Also, I love the insularity of these people who are theoretically on a, you know, essentially international mission to the Antarctic, and they can't tell the difference between Norwegians and Swedes. Like, come on, guys.
He's a pilot.
But
what
but
does he know?
There's the
and he's like six fingers into his bottle of JV already.
It's true. But they find that, like, the Norwegians found an alien spaceship, essentially, and a body in the ice, and that seems to be what killed them. Right. And you know,
one of
again,
the few real parallels to the original movie, by
please.
The way.
Yeah, I was struck by the visuals, how much it looked similar to what I remembered.
It was like John Carpenter said, oh no, all those guys would be dead. They're all dead.
Yeah.
And for, again, more of the story of that, watch the 2011 The Thing, because that's the story of that. But what I wanted to ask is the implication that the spaceship was itself taken over by one of these creatures and it killed everyone on the spaceship and it crashed on Earth, or that the spaceship is the creatures? Because I started to think, you know, is it that the spaceship was in its own horror movie where it was taken over by these creatures and then they crashed on the Earth?
Yeah. Well, basically Alien, except the Nostromo does not get
right. My answer is no, simply because the spaceship that was being built in the cave under the ice by the alien. I mean, it's possible that this alien creature is smart and savvy enough to have paid really close attention to that other flying saucer to just try to make another one. But I don't know. The way that I read it was just this is my technology. I'm trying to recreate it as best I can with, you know, chewing gum and chicken wire and whatever else is around here.
The flying saucer home game edition.
Yeah. And that's one of the few things in this movie I think is just kind of dumb, is that flying saucer.
That's pretty stupid.
I'll make a small flying saucer.
I put me down in the team conquest. That was it. Was the alien coming here to eat up the planet?
All right.
Wait, no, actually, I just changed my mind.
Oh,
because
nobody wants to be on Phil's team.
Just because it wasn't Phil this time. It was the flying saucer being so ridiculous, the silly looking child's toy version of it. So now I have changed my mind. I think that you're right, Jason. It was another horror movie on a spaceship, and this alien is actually not super bright, but it's sort of thinking, oh, I could totally do that because these other people that I took over, they were flying in a flying saucer thing, and it had a bunch of bits and bobs and metal and electricity. And yeah, I could absolutely do that. Mm-hmm.
It's having
yeah,
to build
sure.
a flying saucer out of spare parts. Of course, it's going to look crappy.
I just think it bit off more than it could actually chew. Well, and I'm not talking about the guy's head or hands.
Well, either in the Richard Dysart scene.
Either theory is supported by the opening scene of the ship careening towards Earth, because there's clearly something wrong with it. It actually, there's a little explosion just before it descends to the planet's surface. So it could be because they're fighting off these things, or it could be just, you know, one of those things where you're, oh God, I'm tired of saying thing. It should be one of those situations where your spaceship, you know, just blows up sometimes.
I like the classic nature of the fact that it's the thing that's been buried in the ice for 100,000 years or whatever. Like, that's so great. Right? Like, it's just been down there all that time. but we are the true monsters because the Norwegians are the true enemy. They're the monsters.
Those dog-killing monsters.
The one thing this movie was lacking is the guy who's, no, we've got to keep it alive. We owe it to human knowledge. These are John Carpenter scientists where they're all, kill it dead.
Yep. No, there is the one guy who says, oh, somebody's going to win the Nobel Prize for this thing. That's why we got to keep it around. And then he dies.
But he says it in kind of a jokey way.
Also, I think it's early enough that he doesn't. I've only seen it once. Is that before or after they have the actual knowledge that it could take over the entire Earth?
Yeah, it's before.
Very easily. I think Wilford Brimley has
written down his notes yet about how it could take over. That he conveniently leaves in a notebook out for others to read.
Yes.
Which you have to assume that at that point he's not yet been taken over, because it seems like a kind of a dumb thing to do if you are the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd think so.
Well, these are some of the problems that, you know, you when you examine the movie a few times, it's like, why would he do that?
Again, in a list of missed opportunities, I feel like this movie misses the opportunity of showing somebody being taken over successfully by the thing. And it's because it wants you to keep guessing about it.
Right. Well, you get part of that with Bennings, the first to go. That's, you know, you see him in a pile of writhing tentacles and goop. And then you do see him stagger out onto the ice, and he's almost done with his transformation, except he has those bizarre looking, really long alien hands, which is a great image that sticks with you for a while. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, although you don't see the entirety of what's going on, I'm not sure you would necessarily gain much by that other than another $1 million worth of goop effects.
Right.
Which I'm okay with, but,
again, but that's that psychological kind of aspect of it. What's it like to be taken over by the monster? Yeah. I don't know.
It involves a lot of goop, a lot of tentacles.
What else have we not covered about this?
You know, I sort of jokily introduced myself talking about Canadian snow, but I seriously was very impressed by the look of all of this movie. You had so much. I mean, I will admit, over the last couple of years, I've watched an awful lot of terrible Hallmark and Lifetime romance movies that were filmed in Vancouver where there's no real snow. And like, I've seen good fake snow, I've seen really bad fake snow. And as soon as this movie started, I was really excited simply for the snow, because I was like, okay, this is going to at least look good. And then lots of other things were good too. But in addition to the snow and many of the indoor scenes being shot on a soundstage that was basically refrigerated, so you can see people's breath and all that kind of stuff that looks really good, there's also real fire and real actors using real fire. And I was just really impressed just from scene to scene by how, I don't know, realistic everything looked, and just sort of gritty in a way that appealed to me very nicely. Like, I felt the cold in my bones as I was watching it. It was just so effective.
Right. Nice. Well, that's what happens when you give John Carpenter enough money to realize his vision, and his vision is strong for what he wants to achieve. And unfortunately, when this landed with a dull thud, I don't think he was ever given this kind of money to make a horror movie again. He did spend a fair amount on Big Trouble in Little China, and Starman actually had a pretty sizable budget, which I think is probably one of his other most well-realized films. But as far as horror, I don't think anybody wanted to front this much cash to him ever again. And so you won't see this kind of realism from John, I think, in the rest of his canon.
Yeah, I mean, it changed the trajectory of his career. The fact that he made a classic film, but that nobody went and saw it.
Nobody noticed.
Yeah.
He threw a goopy party and nobody cared. Yeah.
So overall, I guess we should summarize.
I do have a few items.
Oh, yes, Steve.
Here. Because I went through the...
You are our selector of this, so please share.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I did...
Explain yourself, sir.
Our thing docent, as it were.
Yes.
I did put together a very detailed plot synopsis in case somebody else didn't want to.
We didn't end up using it, which is fine.
The plot synopsis is they're on a base and then slowly
it's under siege.
Eaten.
It's under siege and sure. Everybody dies.
Okay.
Except for Kurt Russell and Keith
David. You could have mentioned that to me last night, Phil.
Okay, sorry.
before I took 17 pages worth of notes. But I'll just scroll through here and find if there's a couple of choice items that that I didn't get to mention because they were wrapped up in the plot synopsis. Oh, yeah, you can claim a machine is labeled Chess Wizard, but you can't fool an old nerd like me. That's an Apple II Plus.
It's an Apple II, and why would you have a dedicated chess thing? And it's just a program, although then they have the voice that makes
it
seem cooler.
Yeah.
But yes, and also, you're in Antarctica, dude. Don't short out your chess computer. You're not getting another one.
It's the first day of winter.
He must
winter.
Have been really drunk.
That pinball machine and jukebox is not going to entertain you all the way
the,
through
the
December
and January.
The implication
is that it's the beginning of winter, and so everyone's a little stir crazy. Yeah. They keep making allusions to that in the first act of the movie.
Also, right. I feel it gets across that this is a group of misfits who've chosen to be in Antarctica.
Sure.
And they're not our, you know, our best and brightest.
And also this was 2 years before the Mac was invented, so it was probably just a coincidence. That...
I know. Well, it is Mac who's dumping his J&B into an Apple II Plus. So maybe that's
because it is Steve Jobs literally rejecting the machines of the past.
That's right.
Bring us into it.
Well, you know it's not a Lisa that he dumps on.
No.
So let's see what else. I think it's interesting that this is the second night in a row in which I'm doing a podcast about a movie that features somebody getting shot through the eyeball. Wasn't expecting that. Wanted to mention real quickly that
Goodfellas tomorrow, everybody in?
No.
Might as well do the tribe. Well, there's only two eyeballs in a human head, so I think two is enough. Just wanted to point out, I love that damn dog at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
That is the greatest dog.
Beautiful dog.
And so many of those scenes of that dog just like chilling under the ping pong table, sort of looking vaguely ominous, it works so, so well. And I actually watched some of a documentary about the making of the film. And Richard Mazur was saying that, yeah, that dog is half wolf. And his trainer basically said, he doesn't bark. You know, he doesn't get agitated the same way a regular dog does. But if he gives you that look, that serious stare, don't mess with him because that's when he's about to go off. And you can see that in those scenes where he's just lying around or he's walking through the station. Then he'll like stop and he'll give that look. It's like, oh, man, that's the best damn dog actor I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. There's a funny joke here about Quaker Oats and diabetes that I didn't get to say.
That's right. Once you're part of the thing, you live forever and never die.
Sure. Well, he's pulling out, you know, those organs. It would be a perfect time for him to say, oh, well, clear signs of diabetes. But, didn't happen. I did want to call out, since so many of the effects are good, I did want to call out the one place where I think they're bad, and that's the scene where Windows is being eaten by Palmer after they've been strapped to the chairs. It's pretty clear in those scenes that his flailing body is just a dummy stuffed with straw, which kind of breaks the immersion a little bit. But when you consider how old these effects are, to have one scene that doesn't quite go off, and also so many of these scenes are brightly lit, which is, you know, raises the challenge rating by a vast amount. That whole scene with Norris's head crawling away should look bad. It's a pretty good ratio, I think. Bad scene.
That floppy body is, it, just consider it the very goopy flaw in the bloody prison.
Sure. Well, I mean, they do make an effort. There are scenes where they give you a glimpse of what is the real Windows body kicking around, and then they'll cut to the dummy flapping around, and it's a good effort, but it makes an interesting contrast. And then the last thing is just a bit of trivia. This film was written by Bill Lancaster, who was the son of Burt Lancaster.
Also the Bad News Bears.
He's written three screenplays in his life: The Thing, one of my favorite movies; The Bad News Bears, another of my favorite movies; and The Bad News Bears Go to Japan, which we won't speak of. But I think
he
might
really
have also
excited.
Had a hand in the Bad News Bears remake.
I was really excited to hear what that third one was, and okay.
Yeah, no, I may have said that in the wrong order, but you can't really say the Bad News Bears go to Japan and then go to the Bad News Bears. That would have ruined the surprise, too. But yeah, what an interesting filmography to have written those two films. Very different and both excellent screenplays.
apparently he also wrote a Firestarter screenplay that that Carpenter rejected basically and got somebody
else. Carpenter
to write.
When the thing bombed, Carpenter was kicked off of Firestarter too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
That's why he ended up not making that. So that's it. I think that's enough. Right. I'm very impressed that you guys all managed to talk for an hour about the thing when there's so many anti-horror folks around.
So. You know, I'm not an anti-horror person.
I know
it's just
you
not
are.
my happy place, but I have so many friends and college roommates and stuff who are very into horror that this has always been a huge gaping stomach mouth of a gap that in my movie watching history. So I was very happy to plug it up with my hands. Okay, this metaphor has gotten out of hand, but I was really glad.
Much
that
like
I got
Richard Dysart is out of his hands.
And I happened to be staying in a hotel last night, so watching it on a strange television in a different room was it really made the experience for me. And I'm just I'm glad that it didn't let me down, because after all of these years, I kind of went into it a little bit worried. Like, is this actually going to hold up? Is it going to be the classic that everybody says it is? And thank heavens it was.
Yeah.
Neither Stephen nor I had seen it before, and we both really, really loved it. So thank
Stephen
you.
Loved
thank
it.
You, Steve.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. He's now seen two John Carpenter movies, and we're two for two so far. Starman was the other one.
Wow.
Wow. I was fairly certain that he was going to end up hating it, as you had
Me
suggested.
Me too, but it's spare. There's not a huge cast. It's kind of minimalist. I don't know. It's from the 80s, but it's got a little bit of that 70s greasiness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All,
yeah, there's
good
definitely
things in
a 70s hangover feel to it.
Yeah, it's too cold for it to be smelly, but yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, but you know if it warms up a little
bit.
Yeah,
no, those guys are wearing a lot of layers. It's smelly.
Kurt Russell has an odor.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's all men in an enclosed space. That place stinks.
Yeah,
I mean, they
absolutely.
Specifically call out Long Johns in the kitchen, and I was
true.
Like, all right, yep.
Yeah. No, you look at those guys. They're all wearing 7 or 8 layers, and it mm-hmm. basically smells like somebody's hockey bag.
It's
yeah,
feet.
Yeah, they are making their own gravy.
Yep. Thanks for making it real, Steve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Phil, how about you?
I am anti-horror. No, I'm not anti-horror. I just, it's not a genre that speaks to me. Like so many other genres do. But I enjoy this picture. I enjoy the craft of it. I think it's well put together, and it is not one that I will watch frequently because I hate body horror so much, and it's so goopy and gross. And but really nice on the paranoid stuff. I like the paranoid stuff. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I like the bit about the two guys in the snow eyeballing each other and dying.
Yep.
We hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, if we're lucky. Yeah, I mean, horror, obviously not my favorite genre either, but this is, I don't know, there's something about like when it's an alien monster that's like...
Add some sci-fi in and it makes the horror so much more palatable, doesn't it, Jason?
Other than the organ, the organ extraction didn't bother me because we do all have gooey organs inside us. That's fine. And then everything else was ridiculous, right? Everything else is like a head blob spider creature, right? Which
See,
is like...
the head blob spider creature is when I said, well, sir, I've had quite enough of this.
I just was like, well,
the room for a
that's
bit.
Well, that's ridiculous, right?
It's like, comical.
Yeah.
For me, it didn't push any of my buttons that are like the real kind of like gross out, disturbing things that I find in some horror stuff. Yes, it being a science fiction horror movie helped a lot. That's clear from the first frame when it's like a flying saucer. Like, okay. All right, we're going to be okay. Yeah, this is a classic for a reason. I am shocked that it was so disliked when it came out. There are
Had you seen this one before, by the way?
No, I hadn't seen it before, like 6 hours ago. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really well done. Again, I can imagine some other movies. But again, I think what I'm really saying is this is such a rich vein that there are lots of different kinds of movies you could make with this fundamental premise. And I admire the fact that John Carpenter chose the one he wanted to make and really also chose the one that I think it shows an awareness of him knowing his own strengths. Like, he knows the kind of movie he wants to make here, and he made that movie. And on those terms, yeah, I think it's really great, and looks good. Like, again, he had enough money that not only does the gross stuff good look good, but the like regular stuff also looks pretty good. And the cast is really good, especially Kurt Russell and Keith David, but Wilford Brimley. But they're all good. It's a good ensemble, and you like to see that in any movie like this. So, thumbs up to The Thing. I'll join the party. It is kind of a classic. So thanks, Steve.
You got it. I also enjoy the fact that Richard Dysart has a nose ring.
Yes.
Yeah, that like
in
it
1982
took me
that was still transgressive.
Yeah.
And it took me forever to figure out where I recognized him from. Finally, like, I had to look at IMDb and I was like, LA Law, of course.
Leland.
Yeah, that's a thing that was meant to be like super hang a lantern on who this guy is. And in 2022, mm-hmm. we're like, okay, whatever.
Sure. And he also voiced Uncle Pom, the man that lives in the caves in Castle in the Sky. A little minor guy.
They need to take the scene.
And just in the dub version, Steve. Just in the dub version.
Okay, sure. Okay,
they need to take the scene where his hands get bit off. And recut it so that it has the L.A. Law saxophone and the trunk slamming as his hands are bit off.
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
So get on that, nerds.
Yeah. So for my part, obviously, I think this is a classic. I thought it was a classic since I saw it at probably age 12 or 13. Didn't see it in the theaters, but I think... we did have the, I believe, Alan Dean Foster written novelization, mm-hmm. which I read, I think, the summer it came out, and probably caught it on video maybe a year or two after that. Recognized greatness at the time, and I'm overjoyed that it's been reassessed as a classic and possibly Carpenter's masterpiece. And I'm doubly overjoyed that all of you seem to enjoy it as well. So thanks for... taking this gross, goopy journey.
Oh, goop hug, everybody.
Oh, no.
No.
The thing is...
We'll have to do another old spooky club next year, Steve.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the well of things that I can present to you guys, and hide in the veneer of sci-fi is running rapidly dry, but I'll see what I can do.
No, well, I mean, you don't need to hide. Like old Spooky Club, it just needs to be spooky. It doesn't need to hide in any sci-fi veneer. I think you can, I mean, I get one a year. Yeah, I mean, you now we've got a format, so I can't wait 7 years to do Ginger Snaps. So we'll just have to do it every year. You'll just have to subject me to an old spooky.
I'll start looking now.
Old Goopy Club. We could also do that.
Old Goopy Club.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for now. Steve, thank you very much for picking this movie for us.
Thank you for giving it your eyeballs.
Yeah.
And
I want to keep
it.
My eyeballs. I don't want to take my eyeballs.
No thing, please.
Phil, thank you for being on the journey.
Jason, I want to come inside. Please let me out of this shed.
I want to come in. I need my Quaker Oats. It's the right thing to do to let me out of the tool
shed. I need my diabetes medicine.
And Erica, thank you for being with me in this space under siege.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of Spooky of the Incomparable. Ooh. We will see you next time.